The United States assassinated 9 people in Nangarhar province, Afghanistan, yesterday morning by drone strike. Officials say the targets were militants working with the Pakistani Taliban and Lashkar-e-Islam group. Last Thursday, another drone strike in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border region reportedly killed a prominent Pakistani Taliban leader, Khaure Masood. And in early March, a U.S. unmanned drone dropped bombs on a group in Somalia, claiming to have killed the head of the Al-Shabaab group that the Pentagon claims was involved in the 2013 Kenya mall attack. Bombs dropped by unmanned remote-controlled drones have become routine forms of warfare, allowing the U.S. to pick off people it deems unworthy of life within a complex and secretive chain of command that has almost no public accountability. The ACLU just sued the Obama administration to reveal the details of how and why people are targeted by drones, particularly since some of those people are U.S. citizens. Now, a new book by journalist Andrew Coburn lays bare the evolution of drone warfare as part of the U.S.'s military history. Andrew Coburn is the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, the author of many articles and books on national security. He's also a regular opinion contributor to the Los Angeles Times, and his book is called Kill Chain: The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Welcome to Uprising, Andrew.
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, you open your book with the story of the 2010 drone bombing of a convoy of civilians in Afghanistan. Heartbreaking story. And you point out in great detail the drone operators and the people in this very complex chain of command who assumed that they were observing Taliban militants. Instead, they ended up killing several children, women and men. How did the chain of command of all of the people viewing these civilians from different parts of the world determine that the group in 3 cars were Taliban militants?
Well, they were looking for a pattern. I mean, they were what they saw. Initially, they were watching out because there was an American special forces group had been dropped in. We're going to go and attack a village and kill someone. So they, the drone was watching to look for Taliban reinforcements coming to defend the village. They saw these 3 vehicles, and the first thing they saw heading towards where the Americans were, they saw 2 of them flash their lights at the third. And they thought, aha, that's a sign of...
Can you hear me, Andrew? We just cut out.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, continue. You were saying that's a sign of?
That's a sign of something sinister. Mm-hmm. Sinister. Then they the vehicles stopped, and they saw what they imagined were people getting out and praying. And they thought, well, that's what the Taliban do. It's kind of what 1 billion Muslims do every morning anyway. but they thought, aha, that's a sign, as one of them said, they're going to do something nefarious. Then they saw, they'd also seen a warm, this is all at night, so they're watching it all on infrared. And all they can see really are blobs. They see the heat from the vehicle, and they see sort of warm, you know, heat sources inside the vehicles, which were humans. But they couldn't tell, obviously, if they were men. Well, they certainly couldn't tell if they were men or women or children. They just assumed they were all men. They thought they saw a rifle, which was probably a turkey that one of the passengers was carrying to give to as a present for a relative in Kabul. And they just assumed, they thought this fitted the pattern of a Taliban convoy. And the idea that it might be women or children never entered their heads. Even when someone, one of the watchers in another base in Florida, said they thought they saw a child, they said, oh, well, child, are we talking toddler or are we talking adolescent? They said, probably an adolescent. Well, how old is an adolescent? Well, an adolescent could be 13 years old. Well, 13 years old could be a military-age male. Okay, it's okay to kill him. So everything was forced into this sort of formula that made it okay to kill these people.
And you bring up this very important point, the fact that a military-aged male that fits a certain pattern is essentially assumed to be a target by the United States for extrajudicial assassination. This is just something that might have been unimaginable to openly state a decade ago, but this is just now U.S. policy.
Well, that's right. You know, we sort of cloak it with, you know, we use all this language to obscure what we're doing. So what used to be called assassination is now targeted killing. You know, it sounds nicer. And military-aged male, that sounds better than...
Than a 13-year-old.
You know, it's all this sort of language, which supposedly is all very clinical and military and precise, is actually there to obfuscate and conceal what is actually going on. So if you said we're assassinating 13-year-old, you know, boys, that would sound very bad. As you say, we wouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
But now we thought up a whole new language for it, and now we go with it. And as you go on.
And it's, I think we should really be clear that these are people that the United States, through these unmanned drones, are viewing from 2 to 3 miles up in the air. And you point out how one person, in explaining what happened, said that the pictures are as clear as, you know, images on a rug on the floor. I mean, it's fuzzy. It's not.
Yes.
I mean, they're putting all their faith in a technology that itself is deeply flawed.
Exactly. You got it exactly right. I mean, we're all sold on this idea of, you know, precision. And when you watch movies like, you know, Zero Dark Thirty or American Sniper or whatever, you know, they like to show drone pictures, but the drone pictures always look beautifully clear, you know, in 70 millimeter Cinerama, whatever, or IMAX quality. But in fact, under the conditions, as you say, that most of them operate, which is much higher, 2-3 miles up, and, you know, in bad weather and at night, in fact, most of the time, they can't see that well. In fact, I discovered that for the conditions that they operate most of the time, the level of vision quality they have is 20 over 200. You know, we had a 20/20 vision. Well, this is 20 over 200,
wow,
which, interestingly, is the legal definition for blindness in drivers in most states in this country. So we're sending legally blind machines to spot and kill people.
Now, Andrew, the majority of your book focuses on the history of how we came to where we are today and relying on these drone wars. And I think many of us who are disgusted by the U.S.'s reliance on drones don't know that it goes actually back quite a long way, all the way back to the Indochina War. Can you explain why that was a good starting point for us to trace our remote-controlled wars to?
Right. It started back in the Vietnam era. I mean, I cite this as the birth of the automated battlefield. Mm. As people may remember, the big problem was thought to be that the North Vietnamese could supply their troops and allies in South Vietnam via the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the jungle, which mostly led through Laos, in the remote jungles in Laos. So a bunch of scientists, most of them nuclear scientists, as a matter of fact, thought up this scheme of littering the jungle, this entire area, with thousands and thousands of sensors that could hear, that could sense movement, that could even smell, and they would beam back the signals what they were hearing or detecting back to a giant computer in Thailand, which would then figure out that aha, this sound and that smell and that movement shows as a North Vietnamese supply column. So we'll send bombers and in some cases drones to go and attack it. In fact, it was a complete bust. It didn't work at all. It cost billions of dollars because the enemy quickly figured out what was going on and laid false trails and, you know, would have a truck go and run up and down a road sort of miles, hundreds of miles away. And thus the whole thing was fooled. But it was the same idea that you could remotely sense what was going on in a battlefield. You didn't have to be there, and this would give you all the information you needed to target, to detect and target the enemy you were trying to strike, which really, you know, now we're doing with drones.
And not only was the success of that early program obscured, but also the cost obscured. It cost a lot of money back then, and the drone wars are costing a lot of taxpayers' money today. Can you comment on that?
Yes. I mean, the drones are sold on the idea that this is all very cheap, cheap in manpower and cheap in dollars, which is really very misleading because they say a drone, you know, costs only $20 million. Actually, they're costing a lot more than that now. And, you know, that we don't have to send a pilot, you know. No, in fact, it costs a lot of people to keep a drone flying. I mean, for a for a combat air patrol of Reaper drones, which is our main attack drone at the moment. I think it's on the order of 170 people. Just to look, then you have these armies of people, thousands and thousands of people who are looking at the video they send back. I mean, this unimaginable quantity of video that's streaming back from all over the world every day into these centers, very secret centers we have around. They're called Distributed Common Ground System centers that are dotted around the United States and some overseas. So it's this gigantic effort costing billions of dollars, which is going to cost more because now, whereas we used to have the $20 or $30 million drone, now we're getting up to the, we have drones in service now that cost to an even $300 million, and we're probably heading for the $500 million drone.
Well, we stepped back in time to look at the Indochina War, but there's a middle step in between then and today's drone wars, and this was something that I never really even realized, which was the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA's, strategy of fighting drug wars in Latin America is part of the story as well, in the 1990s in particular. So tell us a little bit about how that plays into this history of remote-controlled wars.
Well, it was this whole idea of high-value targeting, which is central to the whole scheme of what we doing now with drones and other means, special forces and so forth, which has been around for a while. And the idea is that you can pick off, you identify and you pick off the leader of whatever group you're opposed to, and you remove him. And then life becomes much better. So this was advanced, really pioneered in a lot of ways by the Drug Enforcement Administration back in the 1990s. They developed something called the Kingpin Strategy. And the idea was they'd pick off, they'd target the leaders of the infamous cocaine cartels in Colombia. And then, you know, this would do wonders for the war on drugs. Well, it did wonders for the Drug Enforcement Administration because their budget shot up and they became sort of one of the big boys along with the NSA and CIA and people. And it also, in a way, it looked like it was very successful because, you know, the, lots of cartel kingpins were either killed or locked up. But what happened, the effect was to increase the supply of drugs into this country, because when you, simple economics should have made them forecast this. If you, what a cartel does is limit supply and keep up prices. That's what it means. So if you destroy the cartel, or at least destroy its leadership, then what do you get? You get two cartels, or, you know, you now get competition. How do people compete? They compete on price and supply. So the effect was that actually, and you can chart this, this was worked out by a very brilliant analyst I quote a lot in the book, who had a major study on all this. You can see, you can actually look at the graph of the price of cocaine on the streets of America and compare that with, you know, when they took down a cartel leader, and with Pablo Escobar or the leaders of the Cali cartel, each time they get picked up, the celebratory, or killed, the celebratory headlines in the papers, big press conferences in Washington, and the price of cocaine promptly plummets on the streets of L.A.
And so, Andrew, here we have this a similar phenomenon playing out in the battlefields of the drone wars today, where they exported the same strategy of picking off leaders of Al-Qaeda. And now, of course, they're expanding this to leaders of ISIS, where this idea is that if you target the so-called high-value targets, which sounds similar to the DEA strategy of targeting cartel leaders, that you will decapitate the terrorist groups, and they'll simply disappear into the night. But instead, of course, what we've seen is that it has only fueled terrorism. It has only given more motivation for more recruits.
Right. Yes, that's obviously true. And a lot of people sort of intuit this. I mean, clearly, when you do this, you kill civilians, you annoy a lot of people, so they get more recruits. In fact, I was able to show a reveal in the book that in Kill Chain, that actually we know that it has a counterproductive effect, because, as a matter of fact, this same analyst, Rex Ravallo, having discerned the real effects of the counter-cartel policy in Latin America, he was assigned to a secret intelligence cell in Baghdad late in the war in 2007, and part of the military intelligence effort. And he decided to take a look at how effective this high-value targeting actually was. So he took 200 cases where they'd eliminated, mostly killed or sometimes captured, the leader of a local insurgent cell, an insurgent group around Iraq. And then he looked to see what had happened then in their area of operations, which, you know, within the few kilometers surrounding them. And he found that within 3 days, the number of attacks on Americans had increased by 40%. In other words, this is empirical research. I mean, I've been attacked already. People say, that can't be true. You know, it's saved lives. We've taken out enemy king. But, well, no, we know. We know that, you know, in this case, it's the only empirical study that I know of that's actually been done where 200 times, which is a big sample, you know, you kill the guy, attacks on Americans and American casualties go up by 40%. And we can see this, you know, on a wider field, too. I mean, our problems with ISIS these days, which originally we had Mr. Zarqawi, you know, a terrorist leader in Iraq. And after great effort, we managed to kill him. He was succeeded by a guy called Masri, who was actually better, was more efficient, just as cruel, but better at running his organization, caused more mayhem. And finally, so we killed him. What do we get then? We get Mr. Baghdadi, who now controls ISIS, which, you know, controls 6 million people, an area the size of Utah.
And so essentially we're creating martyrs, right, through these attacks.
It's not just martyrs. Yes, they are certainly invoked as martyrs. But what tends to happen is you get someone worse because the new guy who replaces the old guy, first of all, they can learn from the mistakes the previous right. fellow made. You know, maybe he was chatting too much on his cell phone or whatever. And he's usually younger. He has to prove himself. He has to prove that, you know, he's really earned the job. Maybe often he's a relative, you know, revenge Uncle Ahmed or whatever. You know, but certainly whatever causes this, the results are clear. we've seen this in Afghanistan. I quote in the book, a young Taliban leader who was was going around a graveyard of a Taliban cemetery, and he's saying, well, there's so-and-so, and they killed him, and he was succeeded by so-and-so that killed him, and now there's me, and I'm expected to be killed too, but each time we get stronger. It's counterintuitive. You think, you know, you always think, gosh, take out the head guy, like they, and that's going to do us some good. You know, that's why they put such effort into trying to kill Saddam Hussein in both wars and missed, of course.
Well, finally, Andrew, there's a number of issues that your book raises, not only the cost being so huge of these operations, but that they're quite inefficient. And of course, the outcome is the opposite. But some might argue, well, if we bring down the cost and if we make them more efficient, then this might be a strategy that we could pursue. What are some of the conversations that you see or that you think might be happening in the Obama administration, which has banked its entire strategy in the so-called war on terror on this approach? I mean, they must be seeing the outcome of their actions. Or is that not the goal, after all, to actually quell terrorism?
Well, you're onto something there. I think they would, you know, obviously ISIS is a problem, but there's two things going on. One is it's politically... you know, it solves a political problem. It sort of did for Obama, or he was persuaded it would, that if we keep banging, you know, when he's banging away in, Pakistan and Yemen, he could claim, and frequently did claim, that this is a great success and we're killing off enemy leaders and therefore we're getting somewhere. I mean, John Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, said a couple of months ago, we've eliminated 50% of the ISIS leadership. Of their top commanders. I mean, I don't know, did he have a list of the total, you know, all the top commanders in ISIS and you tick one off each time you kill him? I don't think so. But there's that. But the more fundamental reason why it goes on, because this is very profitable. There's a huge amount of money at stake here in terms of, developing ever more supposedly precise weapons. I don't really go into this, but I mean, actually, we adopted our nuclear strategy to this too. We do high value targeting in nuclear targeting in terms of taking out Soviet command posts and so forth. But it's it fits into the whole sort of pattern. Rather than sort of sitting down thinking,
what are we really dealing with here? You know, why, what is actually going on? How can we really deal with these whole populations that are sort of incensed against us? We prefer to take the high tech, you know, the technological route, the big money route, which is politically saleable and, you know, very, very comfortable with the relevant, you know, military industrial complex.
Well, Andrew Coburn, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts on this history.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Andrew Coburn is my guest. He's a Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, and we've been talking about his book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.